cabs. I was singing, I am the scavenger between the sheets of Union, while riding down Center Street. Kim Taylor Bennett. The summer of 2004 was the Curiosa tour across the states, but I was super excited that they were coming back to Europe in the fall. I'd interviewed Interpol a couple of times already, but this time I was following Bloc Party on the first few days of that European tour.
Daniel Kessler. Bloc Party was opening for us on the Antics tour, right when their record was coming out and before they blew up.
Kim Taylor Bennett. On the way to Amsterdam, I remember one of them saying the last time Interpol played there, they'd all taken mushrooms, had an amazing time, and ended up in a club where they saw Nietzsche's face on the bathroom wall. Hilarious. So Interpol. They liked to party pretty hard, but of course they'd see a philosopher's face in some skeevy club toilet. So the plan was to get to Amsterdam and for everyone to take shrooms.
Sam Fogarino. The only faces I can see are melted. Daniel Kessler. That was great. I remember it very, very well. Sam Fogarino. This is what I remember. Oh, look, Sam's here. Oh, my God, he never hangs out. Are you going to hang out with us tonight, Sam? Oh, my God, he's going to eat some mushrooms? Oh, my God. And I was thinking, if you keep this up, I'm not going. It's not that big of a deal. Old guy likes to have fun, too. At that point, I was in a serious relationship, and I was happy to hang up the Hurricane Sam hat. I would get in trouble in private. I was more hotel room guy by that point. But I did go out on that night, and then proceeded to get violently ill. Even before we left the dressing room, I projectile vomited in the bathroom. I remember going, "Why am I here?" I went back to my hotel, and again threw up on the way. I finally got back to my hotel, realized I had some hash, smoked some hash, sat in a bathtub and watched 5 episodes of Family Guy. It was a night of extremes. Daniel Kessler. That night, there was a gigantic entourage of people. We had played the Paradiso.
Jenny Penny. I have those photos. I have photos of everything. Kim Taylor Bennett. Yeah, Jenny Penny was there. She was dating Carlos at the time, so she was on the Interpol bus. Someone had procured these bitter kernels of mushrooms, and we were eating them.
Paul Banks. Shrooms would always make me very happy. I would say my favorite drug is shrooms. I mean, A, they're natural, and B, I never had a bad trip. I liked that kind of hallucinogenic, because I feel like I've always been a very open and honest person to myself. So I wasn't afraid of any dark corners. Daniel Kessler. We all took them backstage at the Paradiso. It's a legendary church. It's historic. There's all these Nazi bullet holes in the side of the building. Or that's what they say. I don't know if it's true, but it makes sense. It felt like a front 242 club, which was the wrong sort of thing on mushrooms. I don't know who it was. But someone out of the clan was fixated on some graffiti that they saw in the bathroom, that they swore was Plato or Socrates or something like that. They wouldn't let it go. We had to get out. It was a bad scene.
Kim Taylor Bennett. So we go to this club, and it's this weird industrial gothy kind of club, and it's everybody. All of Bloc Party, all of Interpol, all the crew. Meanwhile, somehow Jenny and Carlos have brought along this couple, and there's some previous connection. I don't know what the idea was there. There was a sexual vibe, but I don't know what was going on. They were gothy. Jenny Penny. The last time we had been in Amsterdam, Carlos and I had a threesome with her. I loved her and thought she was so fun. But then this time when we came back, she had a boyfriend and she couldn't do anything.
Daniel Kessler. There's 25 or 30 of us just walking through Amsterdam.
Kim Taylor Bennett. Eventually we make it back to this hotel room.
Daniel Kessler. It was Carlos's room, this lime green room. It could use remodeling. We were all peeking. It's mushrooms. You're not able to control shit.
Kim Taylor Bennett. Carlos had maybe dropped E, and there was maybe cocaine around. But Carlos was being sort of a weird. He was being sort of an aggressive overlord of the situation. There was something about his vibe that was very unsettling.
Paul Banks. According to Dave, something pretentious that Carlos was doing was pissing him off and making him get dark. Carlos's hair straightener might have been involved. Maybe he was making a scene about his hair straightener. That could be enough to set him off. If Dave P. was tripping balls and Carlos starts bitching about his hair straightener. But like I said, it was a really fun night.
Sarah Lewitton. This was around the time when nobody could be trusted with an anticipated album because they almost always ended up online. So publicists had to organize these sort of field trips for editors and writers of magazines to hear a CD that had basically been welded into a player. Nils Bernstein invited the Spin crew to a hotel in Midtown to hear the album. Now, when Radiohead's Kid A came out in 2000, a bunch of us were invited to the Hudson Hotel to listen to the album on 6 speakers, and it was catered. By 2004, when Antics was coming out, we found ourselves in a hotel room with Ritz crackers, beer, and a tiny little tinny-sounding boombox. That's how far the industry had fallen. April Long. Antics, obviously, was the album that kind of propelled them into the next level, and that was a surprise. They were an unlikely band to take off in the way that they did. Turn on the Bright Lights was a dark album, and one that you would think would be fairly oblique for a lot of people. I mean, so beautiful and rich and unlike anything else. But for me, the Strokes always sounded like a band that could be big. Interpol, despite that sophisticated richness of the sound, and despite how incredible they looked, and the fact that their shows were riveting and powerful and all of that, it still surprised me. But I remember when my older sister asked for Antics for Christmas. I was like, oh, so people in their 40s in Boston are listening to Interpol.
Nils Bernstein. Initially, Interpol was lumped in with the Strokes. But by the time Antics rolled around, they were their own thing. Antics did better than Turn on the Bright Lights. And when Antics did as well as it did, suddenly at every show there would be these A&R guys from big labels snaking their way backstage. They were being heavily schmoozed in front of us for years. Chapter 66. The Internet rules. Fuck it. Paul Banks. I remember being in Madrid months before Antics even came out, and some guy came up to me and said, I love Evil. I was like, what? Chris Bayo. My best friend Michael emailed me over that summer being like, yo, Antics leaked. Go download it. I downloaded it on Soulseek and just drove around at home in Westchester with my friends. This is between my freshman and sophomore year, smoking a lot of weed and listening to that album constantly. Dave Gottlieb. Nobody wanted to hear it. Nobody believed it. People at labels had been saying Napster was just like kids making and sharing tapes. Daniel Kessler. Bright Lights was before the shift, and Antics was after. Bright Lights was a word-of-mouth thing, college radio, record stores championing it. Getting bigger with every tour. By 2004, we were already part of a new era. Our record leaks 3 months before it's supposed to come out? Right there, you see the past is over. Dave Gottlieb. What could the industry have done? I remember being at a meeting early on, where one of the groups suggested we buy Napster. My attitude was, that's a great idea. The executives at that point, who were freaking out, wanted to shut it down. But my attitude was, why are you doing this? This is the world's greatest listening station. This is all kids are asking for. They want to hear as much of the record as possible and then be able to buy it. John Heilman. They were trying to kill the symptoms, thinking they were attacking the disease. They weren't, and also it wasn't a disease. It was a mutation. It was evolution. And also not stoppable. Dave Gottlieb. Instead, Metallica sues its fans for using Napster. The fans stood up and said, fuck you, we're going to use it more. Ryan Schraber. They were coming to 12-year-olds' houses and arresting their parents and fining them obscene amounts of money, ruining their lives. It was the ugliest tactic imaginable from a PR perspective, from an optics perspective. Alan Light. Yeah, that just caused total outrage. People were furious. I don't know whether Metallica ever fully recovered in some ways. They were just seen as the worst kind of... I mean, the fact that they showed up to the lawyers' offices with a list of the names of their fans just drove people crazy. Ryan Schreiber. Though they had been shitty for a while, Metallica was still a very respected band. But that was the turning point at which they became fully a joke. A rock band being this caricature dinosaur. John Heilman. There was just this global denial. If we sue you out of existence, we can make this go away. Paul Banks. Antics leaking wasn't a big deal to me, personally. Daniel had worked at record labels. He had more perspective, and he worried about it. I was really still on the tip of, you know, fuck, man, this is happening. This is working out. Daniel Kessler. It was June, and the record wasn't coming out until late September. I don't remember being overly pissed. I think I was more disappointed in the fact that you work so hard on something. It's just kind of lame. I want the surprise. I like the unveiling of plans, so that people get the this is what we've been working on, ta-da! But that said, I realize if it leaks, we adjust. And whatever happens, we adjust, and you deal with it. Tunde Edebimpe. When we're touring Cookie Mountain, people would bring burnt CDs to get signed, way more than once. I just want you to autograph it. I remember doing it in one case, because I could see in the person's eyes that they had no idea how horrible or offensive that was. Mark Ronson. I've been in meetings with senior executives at labels who say kids still want to hold that tangible CD, that there's something about ownership. I've had to stop them and say, with all due respect, you absolutely do not understand. You cannot teach a 16-year-old kid who has always had music for free that he suddenly has to pay for it. He doesn't get the concept. Ezra Koenig. People my age, basically our entire adolescence was spent online, but in that early modem AOL chat room world. It's something of a source of pride that we were the generation that experienced that whole tumultuous change in the online world. It basically meant coming of age, becoming 12 and 13, starting to flirt with people, finding weird, perverted chat rooms. We were at the perfect age. And by the time we were 15 or 16, you could start downloading stuff on Napster. John Heilman. Remix culture is a huge thing in this era, and it's conceptual as much as it is practical. You live in a world where chopping shit up and reconfiguring it and making shit out of found art seems normal, much more normal than it was when music was more regimented. Nick Offer. When I first moved to Brooklyn, we were rolling in a crew, and there's this one guy who was in this cooler band that I had really looked up to. And I was saying something about Neil Young, and he was like, you know what? You're in New York now. You need to forget about that Neil Young small-town shit. There's no one that you can meet in Williamsburg right now that's going to diss Neil Young. The sound of New York became everything. You're mixing your whole iPod together, and that's what your band sounds like. I want to point out that that guy in the previously cool band, his band was not cool for much longer. Ezra Koenig. When my friend first showed me Napster, I was in high school. We immediately downloaded this weird rarity called The Little Drum Machine Boy. It was this weird Christmas song that eventually goes into Hava Nagila over this electro beat. That was also when I first heard Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush. I'd read some Q Magazine online feature, and then I took 2 hours to download it, and now it's one of my favorite songs of all time. That was my first instinct when he showed me Napster. Wow. We can find some weird shit now. John Heilman. I like Guns N' Roses, and I like Tribe Called Quest, and I like The Cure and The Smiths. It used to always make me crazy that somehow if you said you like this, you couldn't like that. In the aughts, everything stopped being quite so Bloods and Crips, Jets and Sharks. You could like Nas and LCD Sound System and The Strokes, and people wouldn't look at you funny. No one would think that somehow that was unduly promiscuous. It's mashup culture. Moby. The Strokes were a rejection of the 90s. When you're talking about this period of 2001 to 2011, the subtext is that the 90s didn't happen. I remember when I owned Teeny. The kids who worked there were all very hip 20-year-olds. They would only play records from the 70s and 80s. For them, it was literally like, nope, the 90s didn't happen. Except for Pavement, Blur, and Pulp. Those things from the 90s were okay. Even with Sonic Youth, they'd probably play Sonic Youth from the 80s. The Strokes were so nostalgic.
And Interpol sounds like Joy Division.
Everybody referenced unapologetically something that happened quite a long time ago. But that in and of itself was new. When I was growing up, your credibility and your coolness was based on what new records you knew. And then suddenly, by like 2000, your credibility was based on what old records you knew. Like a really cool 19-year-old in 2000, if they had a Pixies 7-inch, they were cool. If they had 3 Brian Eno albums, they were cool. But if you had a record that was made a week ago, who cares? Simon Reynolds. I think this definitely existed already. It was beginning to happen in the late 80s with fanzine culture. But it really went nuts with the internet. Because then you could actually dig up these really obscure things. You could find all kinds of strange things and things from other countries. Soviet New Wave. That was trendy amongst a clutch of L.A. people, I think, for about a year. Archival knowledge became the supreme knowledge. John Heilman. That's the other thing. Every era and every system of distribution, every set of technological realities, business structures, industrial structures, all of it, every era has a bunch of shit wrong with it, and a bunch of shit right with it. I could make a list on any era. The 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, I could sit down and say, these are the new opportunities, and this is the shit that we lost. And some of this stuff is actually regrettable, and some of it is not regrettable at all. But it's always a mixed bag. Some problems get solved, new ones get created. And the next wave of innovators try to solve the new problems.
Alison Mosshart. When we started, everyone was behaving like it was the same as it always had been. But meanwhile, we're watching everything change before our eyes. Everybody's on the internet, and everybody's reacting to music in a different way. Shows are changing, kids are changing, what they want is changing. Everything was changing all at once, and you're right in the fucking middle of it. But you had all these guys that were like in their 40s and 50s running record labels who were just so fucking hell-bent on radio play. And like I said, I turned my radio off when I was 11, so I was like, that doesn't make any sense to me. To me, that's not the most important thing. The Kills have never played on the radio, but we can perform 2 nights at Terminal 5. We don't need the radio. It's all part of why still I don't know where to land, but that's because there isn't a place to land. That's my theory completely now, that nothing's going to stay the same for any period of time anymore, so we might as well just start behaving that way, you know?
Harmar Superstar. You know what? With Napster, I was like, great. Now more people can hear my stuff, and they'll come to the show and buy a shirt from me. That's fine, whatever. No one's making money off of record sales anyway, it's all advances. Nobody ever made money off record sales. I made maybe 20 grand off one record once. So as long as people are hearing shit, this is awesome. The internet rules. Fuck it. Chapter 67. Disneyfication. Casey Spooner. It all starts in the 20th century and then becomes the 21st century. New York was an isolated 20th century city, and then all of a sudden it becomes part of this global underground. Alan Light. New York stories, in a way, are always real estate stories. It's always, where is the next community of creatives able to land? And what does that mean? How on top of each other are they piled? And with access to what?
Joe Levy.
What people love about New York is what they hate about New York. It's constantly changing. So it was always better before, whenever before was. Basically, whenever the person talking was 22. Mark Maron.
Yeah, I remember when I moved back to New York in the mid-2000s. There was a restaurant there where the drugs used to be. There was a nice Italian restaurant, and I was like, well, this is different.
Joe Levy.
You know that Ramones documentary, End of the Century? Debbie Harry talks about how she and Joey Ramone would ride their bikes around the Lower East Side, feeling like they were kids and all the adults had abandoned the city. It still felt a little bit that way in the late 80s. Sure, Soho was already Soho, but people protested outside the Cristadora on Avenue B in 1986 when it went condo, because gentrification was going to fuck up the neighborhood. The Tompkins Square Park riots and the stock market crash killed gentrification there, but it came back with Giuliani. And then it never stopped. Rental prices start going up in 94 as soon as Giuliani comes into office, and keep going up, way up, until they take a pause in 2001. Apartment sales prices take a few more years to spike until 97. But then it just gets ridiculous. A 10-year run up a mountain, a steep fucking mountain. I have neighbors in the East Village who moved to the neighborhood in 94. Within 5 years, they're talking about how internet millionaires are buying places in their building. 10 years after that, they're selling their place so they can retire. Mark Maron. Manhattan is like a vacation town for people who are not from here. It feels like a weekend retreat for Europeans. We read about it on the Russian Yelp or the French Yelp. It's hard to determine whether we just got old or what, but it definitely is sort of devoid of personality now.
April Long. The mid-2000s, that was the beginning of the Disneyfication of the Lower East Side.
Gideon Yego.
The Pianos Era.
Joe Levy.
Pianos is a club on Ludlow Street, a block north from where the Beastie Boys shot the Paul's Boutique cover, and a block south of the Mercury Lounge. A former piano store gave it a deluxe rock club makeover, two performance spaces. When they made it a club, they kept the sign, so you could feel like the neighborhood wasn't changing as much or as fast as it was.
Sarah Lewitton. Pianos opened up after the Strokes blew up and was this new venue where all the New York bands would play hoping to catch the right person's eye. Sometimes bands from overseas would play there too. I remember seeing Franz Ferdinand with 20 other people. April Long. I never particularly liked Pianos.
James Murphy.
Someone made a shirt that said anywhere but Pianos.
April Long. It was very clean, perhaps too clean. Perhaps that was the problem. We liked things dirty. Dirty and dark. It was too bright and too clean.
Jonathan Galkin.
I wouldn't wish Pianos on anybody.
James Murphy.
I remember a guy coming up to me at Pianos and saying, I'm really interested in DFA. And I just turned to him and said, we would bankrupt you.
Gideon Yego.
Around when Yah Yah Yahs had their first appearance on Conan O'Brien, they had a little after thing upstairs at Pianos. And some girl, who I'd never seen in my life, comes up to me and said, what the fuck are you doing here? And I said, excuse me? And she said, MTV, and gave me the middle finger, and she stuck it down her throat like she was gagging to throw up. I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Who the fuck are you, first of all? And second of all, regardless of whatever art school you just left to come to New York City to have your experience, I grew up here, you know? Like, I've been doing this shit for the majority of my adult life, and these people are my friends. Don't fucking tell me I don't belong here.
Mark Maron.
That was long after Giuliani, man. That's a Bloomberg thing.
Gideon Yego.
Those people. They wanted the weird, the edgy, the marginal, the bohemian out of there, so that they could start putting in the boutique and the commercialized version of what the real thing was.
Carl Swanson.
They rezoned like a third of the city during Bloomberg's administration. Under Bloomberg, it became not ideological. It wasn't a cultural structure during Giuliani, like white versus black, religious versus irreligious, but more data-driven and systematic, and thoughtful in a way. Bloomberg is not someone who sees people as enemies, I don't think. It was about making the city into this prosperous playground.
April Long. I lived on East 3rd between C and D, and when I first moved there, 2002, I had to step over drunks to get in my door on a regular basis. It was sketchy over there. A couple years pass, and it was suddenly people coming in from outside the city, or down from uptown to experience this, you know, gritty, cool downtown New York scene. And then it just got worse and worse from there, to the point where it's like Bourbon Street for douchey college kids. It started with the Strokes drinking at 2A. You'd go there on any given night, and there were these people in these bands hanging out. People heard they hung out there, so they came to look for them. It's a domino effect. Next thing you know, high-rises are getting built next to the Mercury Lounge, and bankers are moving into the Lower East Side. Alex Wagner. The hollow commodification of downtown culture was absolutely real. It's like a Disneyland now. And you could see the beginnings, the green shoot of that commodification back then. And it does parallel the Bush administration, though I wonder if there was enough deep analytical thinking at that point to kind of connect the two. But what you saw was an encroaching. I won't say us versus them, because I think that's too extreme. But authentic people with all their attendant authentic desires and pursuits being encroached upon or pushed out or in other ways marginalized by inauthentic characterless people, whether they were government, business, whatever it was. And there was, I won't say soul-sucking, but there was this kind of vacuumy succubus effect. Either, like, practically, geographically draining, as in you couldn't afford the rent in the place you used to live, or spiritually, as in you were an American living under the Bush-Cheney administration.
Dave Gottlieb. George Bush gets elected. Suddenly 9/11 happens, and all these people are like, wait, this guy's in charge? What's going to make us comfortable? Well, being angry will. The Strokes are angry. All the great things about music come up from that, from anger, from outrage, and from a need to connect with anger and outrage.
Alex Wagner. I absolutely think that those were moments of national trauma for generations that moved through it, and generations that just kind of heard about it. It's a triptych, the election, 9/11, and then the invasion of Iraq. I don't think you can underestimate how much that has changed the internal and external landscape of American identity.
Mark Maron. I originally got involved with Air America to fight the Bush presidency because we saw it as a coup, or I did. It wasn't a conspiracy. These motherfuckers took the opportunity and ran with it. Around 9/11, there was a nationalized sense of we gotta deal with the reality here. There were a lot of people that were killed and now were not safe, so that was what they exploited.
Gideon Yeago.
I started covering politics for MTV, in addition to music. And I remember coming home from Iraq after my first trip, or maybe my second. I was all jet-lagged and walking around the streets downtown. The bars are packed at this point, because the word is out that there is something cool happening in downtown Manhattan. There were all these people shrieking and laughing and joking on the street. I wasn't used to someone screaming on the street without a really negative contact of some kind. And I just remembered getting super pissed. I just went home and locked the door and drank by myself.
Joe Levy.
After the chill of 9/11 passes, you start getting the hotels on the Lower East Side and on the West Side, places where clubs used to be. All sorts of clubs, rock clubs, sex clubs, gay clubs, sometimes all three at once. Boom. Goodbye clubs, hello 12 or 16 floor glass cubes, built for the people whose vision of New York was set by Sex and the City. The Rivington Hotel is practically on top of the Tenement Museum. Think about that for a second. Rob Sheffield. The economy was crashing, clubs were closing. People were worried about their day jobs in a way that they weren't like 3 years earlier. Unemployment became a thing. That all has a big impact on what people think of as possible, and what people fanaticize about. And that's where all music begins, really. I mean, the economy crashed, and then a war started, and an election gets stolen, and all this shit is happening at the same time. Chapter 68. When the President Talks to God. Marc Maron. It's very tricky to find a way to write political music that isn't seen as trite or hackneyed, because the message is always the same. Fuck the powers that be, fuck the liars, fuck the rich. Those tropes are kind of well-worn. Simon Reynolds. Bohemia generally had a problem with the idea of being earnest. During the post-punk era, there was a lot of political stuff. But going through the 80s into the 90s, irony, a kind of super-cool disengagement, became more the response to things. It's quite hard to do politics as a musician. You risk being very obvious and being very earnest. All kinds of things you don't want to be. Most bands would either do it very obliquely, or they would just avoid the area altogether. Marc Maron. Maybe someone like Bright Eyes was doing it a bit?
Jenny Eliscu. Well, yeah. Connor's one of the only people from our generation that's willing to say anything about lots of things.
Connor Oberst. I'd never thought about politics before 9/11. Then, truly out of fear and panic, I started reading and watching. I became a cable news junkie and started reading the New York Times. I was just trying to figure out what was happening. Mark Spitz. Connor Oberst, who is from Omaha, which is about as far from the Lower East Side as you can get and still be in America, was besotted by Ryan Adams, who was besotted by the Strokes, who besotted the British press, who besotted the American press, because they had more humor and style. And so suddenly Oberst was on the enemy cool list. You didn't have to be in a garage rock band anymore to place, because the Strokes had ignited a sensibility more than a sound. You could say that Connor was the best songwriter of them all, by the way. Connor Oberst. I moved officially in January of 2003, but in 2001 and 2002, I was coming here a lot to play, but I'd find excuses to stay. But with the exception of Nick Zinner, who became a close friend of mine, I didn't know anyone from the New York rock world. Rob Sheffield. It's a tragedy that they're not gay. Imagine the children they would have. You would see Connor and Nick together and you'd be like, oh my God, bookends. They were the Harry Styles and Lou Tomlinson of this particular era. Connor Oberst. I had a weird crew. I met Ryan Adams and Leona Ness really early on. He was in his wilder days. I would get some late-night phone calls from him. Same thing with Chan Marshall. I'd get invited to a dinner party at her apartment, and I'd be on cloud nine. Through another set of friends, I met Michael Stipe and Rain and Joaquin Phoenix, and I would end up way on the west side in this whole other world. I'd end up with Zinner at Lit, when they'd lock the door behind you, and there'd be cocaine on every table, and you'd have to wait till six to get out. I was routinely having these experiences. I happened to be here, and I was making music, and I knew all these people, but I was certainly not part of any New York scene. Mark Spitz. Oberst had been around even longer than the Strokes. He was putting out cassettes when he was in diapers, on Saddle Creek Records.
April Long. Saddle Creek was started by Mike Mogis and Connor's brother Justin in the 90s. At first, they just put out records by local Omaha bands, but the kind of cool family vibe scene they created became something everyone wanted to be a part of. The label held on to that DIY ethos, even when some of the bands, like Rilo Kiley, The Faint, and Bright Eyes, obviously, got pretty big.
Joe Levy. The records they put out didn't have a lot in common. The Faint was throwback synth stuff, Cursive was proggy hardcore. Rilo Kiley was Jenny Lewis. But Christ, those were some good records. At that point, indie was an idea. It didn't matter if it was Brooklyn or Los Angeles or Omaha.
April Long. And he was a bona fide prodigy.
Joe Levy.
This is a guy who started recording at 12 or 13, and who had a band when he was 15, Commander Venus, which was signed to the label that ended up putting out Creed. By the time he got to Bright Eyes, he was a veteran, and I don't think he was out of high school.
April Long. He has this rickety little voice and these incredibly perceptive, stab-you-in-the-heart lyrics. In the beginning, he was a bit mysterious. It was like, who is this kid?
Harmar Superstar.
Minneapolis, where I'm from, and Omaha are close. I'd stay at the Faint's house, and Connor would be recording underneath the kitchen table, skipping a math test or whatever.
Joe Levy.
Bright Eyes was all about intensely personal songs, but he had a whole other band, Desaparecidos, which was pure guitar rock with a social-political edge.
Dan Ozzy.
Bright Eyes had a bit of a stigma to it in the early 2000s, as if it was wuss rock, or not manly enough for dudes to enjoy or something.
I get it.
Connor is a good-looking guy with a shaky voice, singing about feelings on an acoustic guitar. I think Desaparecidos was what legitimized him for those doodly dudes who assumed he was just singing about breakups like the rest of his moppy-haired peers. He actually had real shit to say.
Connor Oberst.
It's a little Politics 101, that first Desaparecidos record. We were just saying, look what's happening to our hometown. It's just like strip malls.
Omaha, I don't want to dog it, but it's an extremely segregated town. It's homogenous in ways I find unhealthy. I know there are cool, artistic, and thoughtful people there, but the overall feeling is that it's college football, insurance companies, and agriculture. So it's that classic suburban malaise of how boring and shitty our town is. That's really what that record is about.
Simon Reynolds.
There was some political activism in the New York music community during this time. There was an organization called Downtown for Democracy, and they had a benefit out in Brooklyn, I remember. And the whole thing was to raise money to send people to Ohio to get out the vote for Kerry. Thurston Moore started the label for protest records. I remember getting the press release, and it said something like records that are opposed to war, hatred, division, etc., something like that. It was meant to be the New York local avant-garde making a gesture against what was happening in the country.
Mark Maron.
And then there were protests in New York at the Republican convention. That was some big scene.
Connor Oberst.
I went to the big march. We got up early and got all our friends and walked uptown. We're on foot, and there were all the cops on horseback and in the streets, and all the barricades, and everything was like, it was just really intense. But it also felt good and important. I felt more like a citizen than I ever had. I felt like I need to be observant, and I need to be a part of this, because this is going to affect us. And if we just let the powers that be, like, have their way, what will we be left with? It was already clear, even at the age of 23 or 22, whatever, and being pretty uninformed, I knew. Instinctively, I knew. These people are dangerous. It's crazy what they're talking about. The whole get duct tape to seal your windows and just, like, the fear-mongering? The fear-mongering at that point was so insane, and I was very much affected by it. I look at the songs I wrote even after that. Even if they weren't political, they were tinged with all that from then on.
Alex Wagner. In the 04 election, I voted absentee. I was at a bar in Costa Rica when the returns came in, and I just remember, well, because Bush actually won the 2004 election, it was more of a violent wake-up call. It was like, how could we double down on this? We already know how bad it is. At least back in 2000, we didn't know how bad it was going to be. Well, you wanted to believe that there was going to be a course correction. But, of course, there wasn't.
Connor Oberst.
I wrote When the President Talks to God a day or two after the election. I'd done the Vote for Change tour with Bruce Springsteen and R.E.M. I had to fly to Europe for a month just to do interviews. So I was sitting at the airport, and I was obviously so bummed about the election, just really feeling disillusioned. Chloe Walsh called and said, "Your phone's going to ring in 5 minutes. It's Bruce Springsteen. Pick up." So I'm at JFK, and sure enough, my phone rings and it's him. Bruce says, "I just want to thank you again for doing the tour. It meant so much to have you." And he said, "I understand you're going to Europe today. They're going to be asking you a lot of questions about the country. And you have to tell them there's half of us over here that don't feel that way. Keep your head high. Tell them we tried our best, and we're going to keep working over here." He just gave me this pep talk. It was super sweet. So that's what I said to people when they asked me the question. I was over in Europe, taking the ferry from one stop to another, and I just wrote that song really quick on the boat. I played it that night in London. I guess there's a certain tradition of talking blues and that kind of thing, but it's not a well-written song. It was just to make this point. I felt obligated. Dan Ozzie. Connor was scheduled to play Leno. That was before YouTube would have the clip up the next morning. So when a cool artist from your scene got on a big show like that, you had to tune in or you'd miss it. Connor Oberst. There was a thing for weeks between me and Chloe and the head booker. I kept saying, "I think I want to do the president song." And Chloe's like, "That's awesome, but really?" She stuck with it, and it went up the chain of command past the booker. I forgot the woman who was the head producer, but she and Chloe talked, and then I think it even went to Jay's desk, and they agreed. Dan Ozzie. This is 2005. George W. Bush had just somehow gotten re-elected off of his campaign of lies and fear and was fucking the country up with two wars. The U.S. was going down the shitter, but no one was saying anything. The Dixie Chicks protested the war and were slammed over it. People were afraid to seem anti-American. Connor Oberst. When we showed up that day, I was super nervous, and there was a weird feeling in the air. People that worked there knew it was going to happen. There's a knock on the door of my dressing room, and it was Jay. And he's like, "I think it's great what you're doing." And he told me the story about how during the Vietnam War, he and other comedians had done this tour through Canada for all the draft dodgers. He was very supportive. Dan Ozzie. There was this rumor going around afterward that Leno did not want him to play that song, which was believable since it wasn't on either of the albums Connor was promoting, and because Leno was waving the flag of patriotism a lot then. Connor Oberst. So there I am, talking to my mom on the phone, and I did the sound check like whatever in my hooded sweatshirt. But there are 3 or 4 hours between the check and the taping. Something about it just didn't feel right. And so I said to my tour manager at the time, this old-school rock dude, "I don't know, man, I'm feeling weird. Do you think you can get in a costume or something?" He said, "Yeah. You want to be a cowboy?" And because we were in L.A., he called the prop shop and got me that rhinestone suit in the nick of time. And I cruised out there, and no one had seen me dressed. It was secret. I stepped out, and I saw their faces. Now I'm this cowboy, and I can do it. If you pretend, you can do anything. Dan Ozzie. Connor gets up there on national TV, and it's just him, playing an acoustic guitar dressed like a cowboy. The whole song is a fuck you to Bush and the fake religious shit he would hide behind. Called him out on ignoring the lower class, about hiking the price of oil, about raping women's rights, even his fake accent. Holy shit! You don't get to see stuff like that on national television every day. And the weird thing was, you could hear voices in the crowd in between verses, screaming like the guy was Elvis. Because it was such a punk thing to do, to get on TV and punch the president right in his mouth, you wanted to believe someone told him not to do that. But he did it anyway. Chapter 69. We were all starring in our own nightlife type of reality TV.
Jenny Eliscu. The more promotional, or at least slightly cheesier, and therefore also more commercially palatable, version of Tiz was Miss Shapes. Justine D. Things started to change in the mid-2000s because of PR, online social media, and online marketing. With all my parties and anyone that I've been affiliated with, it's never been about celebrity. And I've always said that it's about playing good music first and foremost. It's not about who's at your party. Unless you're David Bowie, Susie Sue, or Mick Jagger, I couldn't really care less about you. If anything, the freaks who come to our parties, they were the celebrities in my eyes because they were outcasts. But it all started to change in, like, 2005, and I think a lot of it had to do with misshapes. Trisha Romano. The misshapes were the embodiment of anyone being able to become a celebrity. Lee Lazark. We started misshapes because everything was boring.
Thomas Honorato. New Year's 2004 was the first party. It wasn't at a club. It was at their house.
Lee Lazark. We did it on a whim in our apartment.
Jordan Nicol. On 11th Street across from Webster Hall.
Lee Lazark. I made my dress. We all made our outfits. Sarah Lewitton. If a bomb went off at that moment in the exact spot, who the hell knows what pop culture would be like today? But I can tell you that everyone at that party would have died happy.
Jordan Nicol. Then somebody said to us, we have a bar space. Do you want to do a party there? We thought it was sort of a joke and didn't really take it seriously until we saw how successful it was becoming and how fun it was.
Sarah Lewitton. The party started off as a place where people that knew each other from motherfucker would go and make out and get drunk and just have a dumb fun time. I often had to be told, very politely, to stop spraying people with champagne. I made out with more gay boys and women during that weekly party than I had in my life.
Thomas Honorato. The misshapes were all underage at Tiz Was. That's how I met them. They were little babies.
Lee Lazark. I was DJing at Lit on Mondays when I was 17. I didn't have a fake ID at the time, but I had records, so I would bring the records, and it was like that was my ID.
Jordan Nicol. If you say I'm DJing, they're like, go right in. Thomas Honorato. Miss Shapes was always on Saturdays. The first months were nothing special. I mean, it was a cute party, but like, if we got 150 people, we kicked ass.
Sarah Lewitton. Eventually, the party just kept on growing and growing with a line out the door. Thomas Honorato did an amazing job at curating who could and couldn't come into the party, so there were a lot of really good-looking people and media professionals, which ultimately caused the party to get a lot of press.
Thomas Honorato. The initial build was very true to the audience.
Trisha Romano. The misshapes' whole thing was stars from the 80s and 90s or 2000s spinning records or playing their iPod.
Greg Krellenstein. The second week was Boy George. Jordan Nicol. The third week was The Rapture. Obviously, there was something going on in New York at that time with music. All those bands that were coming up during that time all lived and hung out where we lived and hung out. Greg Krellenstein. We never really, like, went through a manager. Jordan Nicol. We never did it professionally, only when someone like Madonna came, and even then, they contacted us. There was no fee, no one asked for a fee, and we didn't give any. We made, like, $100.
Lee Lazark. You could be the best DJ or the person that's never DJed, and it's all good. Trisha Romano. The whole idea that anyone could be a DJ, at the time I was very resistant to that, because I spent the majority of my career telling everyone that, no, not everyone can be a DJ. It actually takes talent. But what the misshapes were doing is they were taking the talent out of it, and they were just letting people be selectors. And anybody's selection was as valid as the next person's.
Jordan Nicol. You could play anything you wanted. That was the point.
Lee Lazark. We literally had people playing wolf songs once.
Jordan Nicol.
What we've always said is that we understand the difference between trying to school people and going to a party where it's about fun first. I don't want to go to a party and get schooled.
Lee Lazark. Like it's an intellectual thing.
Jordan Nicol.
People just want to have fun.
Lee Lazark. It was always supposed to feel like a house party. You want to feel comfortable and let loose.
Thomas Honorato.
It was the natural evolution of Tis Was. They understood the collision between dance music and indie.
Moby. I loved Miss Shapes. It was attractive people dancing to interesting records, and they had the decency to sell alcohol. Also, I liked any event that didn't happen on a Saturday.
Sarah Lewitton. It was a very young crowd. They drew all the people who would have been waiting for Motherfucker or other parties, except now they had somewhere to go every single week.
Mark Ronson. I started going to Miss Shapes. I was even a little jealous. This is the younger crowd. This is hipper than our scene. This is what's going on now. The kids couldn't mix or blend for shit, but it was a good energy.
Jordan Nicol. There wasn't anything that was really like pushing new, of-the-moment music. At the time, Friendster and MySpace were on the rise, and there wasn't any party that understood what that could do for you. Miss Shapes just came during a perfect storm of no one doing anything exciting, the music scene exploding, social media, and we had access.
Thomas Honorato. They were obsessed with new talent and new material.
Jordan Nicol.
We had Napster in high school, sure. By the time we were about to do our party, that was the best way for us to get music. We were burning CDs every week. People would say, "What was that? What are you playing?" And they were always pushing for new music and new bands. We had like The Killers when they were starting, Franz Ferdinand, The Gossip, Block Party. We had them either perform or DJ there. Especially in the beginning, it was part of their promotional stop to come DJ Miss Shapes before the album comes out.
Thomas Honorato.
The first year we started, it was like, oh my god, there's this new band you have to hear. They're called The Killers. The lead singer is so cute. Cut to 8 months later, I'm holding Brandon Flowers' hand, walking him through the club.
Jordan Nicol.
At that time, everyone was throwing those other parties, and we couldn't relate to all of them. They were all ancient.
Thomas Honorato.
The Miss Shapes didn't care about what came before them. They did not care about the people that were ruling the scene. What they cared about was their party, making it amazing, and being true to that whole group of kids that they felt like were Generation One.
Nick Mark. The Miss Shapes kids were all regulars at Tis Was. Then decided to start their own party.
Jordan Nicol.
I will say this. None of those people supported us. None of those people came to anything, and for the entire time we did Miss Shapes, we only got negative feedback from them.
Thomas Honorato.
There was a lot of, who are these kids? They came out of nowhere. I didn't know who they were 8 months ago, and all of a sudden they have this big party. And also, why haven't they asked us to DJ their party? All this dumb shit. I was stuck in the middle, and a few people got really mad at me. And a few people were not my friends for years. The Miss Shapes were really unapologetic about these kinds of things. Which is also very rock and roll. Their attitude was, we're gonna do a good party and not give a fuck about any of you. And I thought it was great.
Nick Mark. It always seemed to me that it was more about fashion than it was about music, and I kind of resented it.
Jordan Nicol.
In the beginning it was like Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Franz Ferdinand, James Iha, Block Party, The Hives. Then later it was The Killers.
Greg Krellenstein.
My Chemical Romance.
Jordan Nicol.
Kelly Osbourne.
Lee Lazark. Sienna Miller DJ'd once.
Greg Krellenstein.
Recently I found out that Lena Dunham went to the party.
Jordan Nicol.
She says she has photos of her on the wall.
Greg Krellenstein.
Paul Rudd.
Jordan Nicol.
Sarah Jessica.
I think a big thing for us was when Chloe Sevigny came, because she came by herself, or with maybe one friend, just to dance.
Lee Lazark. When Kathleen Hanna came and all of La Tigre came, I kind of died. I literally just stumbled over every word. They came for Jarvis.
Greg Krellenstein. We were named after a Pulp song, and had been very inspired by Pulp and Jarvis Cocker.
Lee Lazark. And when he agreed to DJ the party, we were like, whoa, it was almost too real. He started playing Joy Division. That was his first song he played, and literally the entire dance floor. I've never seen this before. It went silent. And then everybody started clapping, and I got weird goosebumps. I had to kind of take a second.
Jordan Nicol. I remember Greg freaking out when Michael Stipe came. Thomas Honorato. Yoko Ono came. She did interpretive dance in the DJ booth. Jordan Nicol. For me, I think the time when I was like, this is insane now, was when M.I.A. came, and then spent the whole entire time fighting in the car with Diplo outside. There was all this drama trying to get her out of the car, and the police came.
Thomas Honorato. In the first year one night, out of the blue, Gavin McInnes from Vice showed up with Selma Blair. They were plastered and having the best time. We didn't have a real coat check, so friends and family stashed their stuff up in the DJ booth. Of course, Selma's wallet fell out of her purse. Cut to 2 hours later, it's mobbed. She can't find her wallet, and all of a sudden the music turns down and I hear Jordan's voice on a microphone. Did anyone find Selma Blair's wallet? We were not a celebrity-driven party. Every celebrity who came would leave completely sweaty, just like everyone else. Jordan Nicol. The only time that we ever did anything special for somebody was Axl Rose. We made this little, like, area for him. It was Lee, Axel, and some other dude.
Lee Lazark. Sitting there was so weird.
Jordan Nicol. I think he was expecting the bottle and models situation. It was like, you're at the wrong party. There's like some homos having sex behind the curtain over there and people dancing on the bar. You got the wrong place.
Trisha Romano. Miss Shapes had the celebrity aspect, and this was right around the time that reality TV was also getting big. So we were all watching reality TV, and we were all starring in our own nightlife type of reality TV online with blogs everywhere, celebrity culture. And you had all these things converging. Anybody could become a celebrity.
Thomas Honorato. They were really smart. They showed up. They did their job. They were so smart with those bookings. They hired a PR person really early. They hired a door person really early. Like they met with me before they started the party. Would you please be our door person? And I was sitting there going, oh my God, they are so going to be the next big thing. And there they were in all black, looking like these interesting little characters out of an Edward Gorey book. Jordan Nicol. We had a friend we hired to do the photos, and he was there from the beginning.
Lee Lazark. His name was Scott. He was perfect because he was really tall, so the photos were really flattering. Justine D. They had that white wall that everyone took photos in front of, and then they'd post them online. They really documented everything. And they were savvy in that way where kids were clamoring to get on their website on Monday morning to see if their picture had made it. Trisha Romano. It took on a life of its own. It became all about what everybody was wearing. Miss Shapes started taking on this totally different thing, and part of that was where everybody else became the star. They were posing in front of the wall and paparazzi were there.
Thomas Honorato. Mark Hunter, the Cobra Snake, and then little Nikki Digital. Those were the photo sites. These were the guys documenting what happened last night. Before that, because I'm old enough to remember this, you felt really amazing if you got your photo in Paper Magazine. That's when you were like, oh my God, I'm so cool, I have arrived. And then it was like, oh my God, I'm on last night's party. It's all keyed into the rise of social media and the web, and this new generation of kids.
Trisha Romano. Suddenly there were all these photographers at clubs. All of this coincided with the time that digital photography became affordable for everyone. The ability to buy a basically professional-grade, fast-speed digital camera at a cheap rate, all of a sudden people were becoming photographers.